Radio Catskill, WJFF.
From WJFF, Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Reporters Roundtable, Radio Catskill's Patricia Barbayo speaks to journalists in the region about foie gras farms in Sullivan County fighting the ban on foie gras being sold in New York restaurants, the state of mental health services in Hudson Valley, and why rents are rising in Ulster County. Woodstock Uncovered, Bethel Woods Museum Director Dr. Neil V. Hitch takes us on a tour of the 1969 festival grounds to discover the archaeology of Woodstock, one of the six sculpture installations built by the original art crew. If truth be told, Mackenzie W. Kell gives us a preview of the storytelling performance tonight at the Keshecton Pump House and the healing power of storytelling. Pride in Calicoon, the celebration is today, and it's on the 20th anniversary of Day to Be Gay. We'll hear a special song, but first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. The British Defense Ministry says it believes Russian forces in Ukraine are renewing their efforts to move south from the city of Izium. Bill Marks reports from London.
In a regular update posted to Twitter, the UK's Defense Intelligence said Russia has likely renewed its efforts to move forces south from Izium to further surround the pocket of Ukrainian resistance that remains near the town of Severodonetsk. In response to Russian claims about the establishment of humanitarian corridors to evacuate civilians in contested areas, the UK says these have previously been used as a, quote, mechanism to manipulate the battle space and forcibly transfer populations. The update also posited that if Ukrainian civilians do not willingly accept transfer to Russian-controlled territory, Russian forces may not distinguish between them and military targets. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marks in London.
With the war in Ukraine raging in the east of the country, European Union leaders expected to endorse a recommendation that Ukraine and neighboring Moldova be put on the path to EU membership. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky welcomed the move in his latest video address. A standoff over New Mexico's primary elections has come to an end. The Otero County Commission has reversed itself and voted 2-1 to certify the results, after the state Supreme Court ordered the certification and the Attorney General threatened legal action. Commissioner Coy Griffin was the lone no vote.
I don't have an agenda behind this. I'm not trying to overturn an election. I just want to make sure that our electorate is legal and only legal votes are getting counted, and they're only getting counted once.
Griffin had to dial into the meeting because he was in Washington, D.C., where he was sentenced after being found guilty of entering restricted U.S. Capitol grounds during the January 6 attack last year. He was sentenced to time served, a fine, and community service. Yesterday, the deadline for New Mexico's 33 counties to certify their primary results. Today, people in several cities planning to march 2.5 miles to commemorate the country's newest holiday, Juneteenth. NPR Cheryl Corley reports on the recognition of the 2.5 years it took for slaves in Galveston, Texas, to get word that the Emancipation Proclamation declared they were free.
These short marches, a day before the official June 19th date, are a continuation of the annual walking campaign that started years ago when then 89-year-old Opal Lee walked 2.5 miles in several cities as part of the push to make Juneteenth the national holiday. Now, 95-year-old Lee, who's called the grandmother of Juneteenth, is walking again with the hopes that the holiday brings a new message.
That we are actually one people. We can do more together than the division we have now.
Lee says she's also looking forward to the festivities that recognize the one-year anniversary of Juneteenth as a federal holiday. Cheryl Corley, NPR News.
This is NPR. Police in Brazil say human remains found in the Amazon rainforest belong to the missing British journalist Dom Phillips. The remains of a second person are believed to be that of Bruno Pereira, an expert on indigenous groups. Police say they were led to a grave in the jungle by a fisherman who confessed to killing the two. They vanished nearly 2 weeks ago. The fisherman and his brother are in custody. Police say they're also looking for a third suspect. A recent United Nations report notes a significant spike in the number of migrants, and especially children, crossing the Darien Gap from Colombia to Panama on their way north. The gap is a dangerous wilderness. It claims lives, as Maria Martin reports.
The UN's Agency for Children, UNICEF, says the number of child migrants crossing the Darien Gap from Colombia into Panama last month was four times that of a year ago. 2,000 children crossed in May of 2022, as compared to 500 one year ago. The spike in migrants is expected to continue as Latin America's economy reels from the impact of the pandemic, climate change, and the world recession. About one in five migrants crossing the risky Darien Gap is a child, often unaccompanied. UNICEF is urging the region's governments to double their efforts to care for and protect these children, especially as conditions worsen with the rainy season. For NPR News, I'm Maria Martin.
Playing today's third round of the U.S. Open Golf Tournament, just getting underway. The first players are teeing off in Brookline, Massachusetts. Colin Morikawa and Joel Damon share the lead. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing a transformative approach to justice that is community-led, restorative, and racially just. Learn more at publicwelfare.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Every month, Radio Catskill's Patricia Rubio speaks to journalists in the region for the monthly Reporters Roundtable. This month, he's speaking to Liam Mayo of the River Reporter, Chris Rowley of the Shawangunk Journal, Joseph Abraham from the Sullivan County Democrat, and Philip Pantuso from the Times Union. A gathering and talking about, among other things, the state of mental health services in the Hudson Valley, foie gras farmers in the Sullivan County area fighting back against the foie gras ban in New York City restaurants, and why rent is so high in Ulster County.
Hi, my name is Patricia Rabao, and I'm a producer with WJFF Radio Catskill. Welcome to another edition of the Reporters Roundtable. Joining me today are journalists Liam Mayo of the River Reporter, Chris Rodley with the Shawangunk Journal, and Joseph Abraham from the Sullivan County Democrat, and Philip Pantuso from the Times Union. Before we get to today's roundtable, just to remind you that the Reporters Roundtable has a podcast. For full interviews, search WJFF, the Reporters Roundtable, wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Joe, what can you tell us about the latest news with Garnet Health? The hospital in the Catskills, they were looking to do away with their critical care unit, but according to the Department of Health, they can't. What can you tell us about that latest development?
So when it comes to hospitals, it's sort of a what a difference a year makes situation because, you know, we were looking at in the middle of the pandemic, they were seeing record level volume. And so while you don't think about it from a business perspective, I would assume business was, you know, quite well in terms of the fact that lots of people were using the hospitals. They also were receiving some federal funds. So, you know, their finances were in better shape. We recently spoke with Jonathan Schiller, who's the outgoing CEO of Garnet Health Medical Center Catskills. His last day was last Friday. He took a position at Oneida Health, and Jerry Dunleavy is going to be taking his place. And pretty much he was explaining how, to me one time, that they just weren't able to fill beds in many of their units, and how cost of labor, supplies, pharmaceuticals, temporary labor, that, you know, they hired the travel nurses and such, which come in at an expensive rate. Premium payments were off the charts with this low volume. And he said that the Garnet Health System as a whole was actually around $30 million behind budget, whereas the local Garnet Health Catskills Hospital was about $5 million behind budget alone. So to address this, the hospital sort of been making some decisions. Them and the board recently decided to consolidate the medical surgical unit. It's the third time that that's been done. And another thing they tried to do was they put an application out with the Department of Health, as you mentioned, to temporarily close their critical care unit for 4 months. So once the news got out there that they had put that application forward, many nurses locally were protesting, and the State Nurses Association, was protesting. In fact, the story even made it up into the Times Union, up into to Phillips' paper up there, just because of the attention that it was getting. And Aileen Gunther, our assemblywoman, has been very outspoken about, you know, why the critical care unit couldn't close. And there was a lot of concern about patient care because, look, we live in the middle of the Catskills. If they were to not have a critical care unit, you'd have to go at the closest. You have to go visit our friend Chris up in Ellenville, or you'd have to go to out to Middletown as far as your other options. So there was a lot of concern about that. And Albie Bachman, the county coroner, who also is a founder of Mobile Medic EMS, was recently talking in the legislature about just the transport times and how they were having to take people anyway before this application went through down to Orange County and sometimes down to Westchester. And some of the challenges that is presented, you know, leading into the summer, which is when our Catskills are the busiest. You know, there was a lot of advocacy by, you know, Gunther and these nurses for the DOH to reject it. And DOH came, made a decision and said, you cannot temporarily close your critical care unit. Gunther called it a victory. The Nurses Association gave us a statement and said they were relieved by it. You know, on a local front, I reached out to some of the county legislators for their perspective, and a couple of them, you know, talked about how they need to find a balance, Garnett, because on one hand, they don't want to see critical departments close, but at the same time, these financial challenges remain. You know, the $5 million in the hole, the $33 million system-wide in the hole, they're not just going to go away. So the financial dilemma is likely to continue. And so I had asked Jonathan Schiller, before he'd left, so what's next? And, you know, at this point, they said that the hospital was going to be, you know, evaluating all of their options. And I should point out that no one's been laid off during this process of consolidation. They've just pretty much, I think, been moving people around, or if they weren't renewing contracts, I believe, don't quote me, as we like to say, it was a lot of the temp help people. But as far as the regular employees, there haven't been any layoffs. So, yeah, so they have to try to figure out, going back to the drawing board, the hospital, as far as how do you deal with these financial challenges at hand.
When this news broke first, I was seeing some comments online from people wondering whether the hospital could be on a path to one day close. In your reporting, have you seen any signs that could make that true?
Their CEO told my boss that they have an unwavering support in Prenitom to Sullivan County, and they're actually looking at expanding a lot of services as far as what's being offered. The rumor is that's out there, not that's been confirmed by the hospital, is that there might be, you know, some services that are diminished over time at this particular one. But I haven't heard anything about anything viable about a closure. The hospital's in any danger of closing, but we'll have to see, you know, as far as, you know, other, you know, they have Orange County, Garnet and Orange and that as well. So, you know, we'll have to see. But yeah, as far as everything they've been saying is that we're not closing or, you know, supporting Sullivan County.
Keeping on mental health and public health, Philip Pantuza from the Times Union is back on the Reporters Roundtable. What can you tell us on what you're working on when it comes to mental health?
A positive update on the mental health situation, at least in Ulster County, but it's going to help folks out in Sullivan County too. A lot of listeners might have remembered back early in the pandemic, Westchester Medical Center, which operates the Health Alliance at the Hudson Valley, shut down its behavioral health unit at its hospital in Kingston, which that contained 40 inpatient psychiatric beds and 20 beds for detox and rehab. And at the time, they claimed that this was being done, and I think there's some truth to this, in order to meet a state mandated requirement for bed capacity in case of COVID surges. But those beds were the only inpatient mental health and detox beds in Ulster County. They also served a lot of patients in Sullivan County, which doesn't have inpatient services for those particular services. Those beds were never actually used for COVID patients, but they've stayed closed for more than 2 years now. And Westchester Medical Center had neglected to make any kind of commitment to reopening them at any point. even though the executive order has long since expired, requiring that they maintain a certain capacity. Well, the update here is that after a lot of kind of tough conversations between Ulster County and the State Health Department and Westchester Medical Center, late last month, they announced, they jointly announced an agreement to bring back some of those inpatient services to the renovated Kingston Hospital on Mary's Avenue. Opening, the timeline right now is first quarter of 2023. So right now what they're looking at is 20 inpatient mental health beds, which is fewer than what were closed. But what's happened in the meantime is that the county has made a pretty large investment in trying to stand up more services along a continuum of care for psychiatric patients and patients in need of detox and rehab. So there's more outpatient services now and more services for people at different points along the care of need. So hopefully they don't have to, you know, get to the point where they require an inpatient bed. So that's actually good news. And frankly, this is something I was reporting on for a lot over at the River Newsroom. And then just did an update on it for the Times Union's Hudson Valley coverage. Frankly, it's something I didn't think was going to happen. I kind of had a running joke with the press person for Westchester Medical Center, who was often trying to get me to write about the new cardiac catheterization center or all these other new things. The joke was like, I'm finally writing a positive story about Westchester Medical Center. That's actually good news. And I dug as much as I could and really couldn't find anything bad about it. Frankly, even the nurses unions who have been leading the protests and the calls for bringing these services back seem pretty satisfied. They're skeptical, I think, of, you know, the timeline, which I totally get it. They've been sort of lied to on many occasions throughout this process, but, It's certainly a win for Ulster County and for Sullivan County, which again has a lot of people in crisis and faces a lot of challenges on these fronts.
Right, it is good news. It's good to hear that services are coming back and not being cut, especially for something very important as mental health. So you're listening to the Reporters Roundtable. I have been your host, Patricio Robayo. We'll be right back with Leah Mayo from the River Reporter and Chris Raleigh from the Shawanakuk Journal.
The Supreme Court is set to rule on a Mississippi law banning abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The decision could overturn Roe v. Wade, affecting access to abortion care for millions of Americans. Keep listening to All Things Considered and NPR News for the latest updates and analysis, as well as live special coverage when the court's decision is announced.
Your NPR station for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. Radio Catskill, keeping you connected.
Juneteenth is a really specific thing. It's a celebration of freedom created by and for Black Texans. So now that it's a national holiday, do we really understand it? Let's ask Black Texas. I'm Kai Wright from WNYC. Join me for a live national edition of the United States of Anxiety. We'll party in Houston, learn history, and take calls from your own cookouts. The traditions and joys of Juneteenth.
This Sunday, Juneteenth at 6 p.m. here on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Let's get back to the Reporters Roundtable with Patricio Robayo.
Let's turn the page over to you, Liam. New York City banned the sale of foie gras. That affects us here in Sullivan County because Sullivan County has two of the largest makers of foie gras in Sullivan County, LaBelle Farms and Hudson Valley Foie Gras. What can you tell us about this developing situation? Because I know it's been ongoing for a while, about the impact that it's having on those two farms.
Just in terms of the timeline of the law, there was a law that was passed back in 2019. I believe it was passed, signed into law on November 25, 2019, banning the sale of foie gras in the city of New York. That law had sort of a 3-year window before it went into effect. It's going to go into effect on November 25, 2022. So there's still a few months before then, but the recent development in it is that Sullivan County's foie gras farms, or Hudson Valley foie gras and La Belle Farms, have filed a lawsuit against New York City claiming that the city has overstepped its authority in imposing this ban. And a lot of the argument that they're making rests on the kind of impact it will have on Sullivan County's farms. They're saying that New York City isn't just legislating this one thing that's being sold in New York City. They're indirectly attempting to legislate something in Sullivan County, which is outside of their authority and is also protected by several statutes, at least one statute of the state's agricultural law. If you listen to the words of the people who were in support of that bill, they knew that that was the effect they were going for. They specifically wanted to prohibit the practice of gavage, which is a practice that involves feeding tubes being stuck down the throats of the ducks that then get turned into foie gras. It's the fatty duck liver, I believe, that is what foie gras is. And it's been decried as an inhumane practice, and New York City Council wanted to end it, so they banned foie gras, sort of knowing that it was going to have an impact on these Sullivan County farms. That impact is still theoretical, mostly. It's close enough to the ban coming into effect that it's starting to impact their planning, which is why they're able to file the lawsuit now. Hudson Valley is set to lose around $5 million in sales and anticipates losing around 20 to 25% of its workforce. La Belle looks to lose around $3 million and looks to cut most of its 100 employees, which those are some of the biggest businesses in Sullivan County. And they also do a lot of business with feed providers and gas providers and other secondary providers in Sullivan County. So they're basically saying that New York City wanted to pass this law to put them out of business, and New York City can't do that. So we'll see whether the courts say New York City can do that or not. The people who are from the foie gras farms embarking on this lawsuit say it could potentially set precedent, because if New York City can have this kind of an impact on the foie gras industry, could it have that same impact on the meat industry? We're banning everything that isn't from grass-fed cows. Could it have that same effect on the egg market by banning everything that isn't from cage-free chickens? So it's, in one sense, a small lawsuit because it only impacts two businesses, but the ripple effects from it could be much farther. And so we'll keep an eye on that as it continues to develop.
Right. And I think I'm glad you mentioned the ripple effect that this could happen. It might only affect two farms, but the ripple effect that it could have on other businesses that support that farm, like feeds and other industries like that. Now let's take a look at what's going on in Ellenville and Ulster County. Chris Rowley from the Shawanagunk Journal. We talked earlier about the state of mental health in Sullivan County and other parts of New York. What is the state of mental health services in your neck of the woods?
I'm sort of in the middle of the early part of research on this story, and it's really from the Ellenville angle. I was interested to hear Phillip's descriptions of the back and forth between Westchester and Kingston. That probably fills in things for us that I hadn't understood yet. Our issue at this point is, in Ellenville, there is a building, the Trudy Farber building, was put up by the Resnick family. And it was specifically sort of designated for the mental health services. And for years, there was mental health provided. Mental health services were provided by the county in that building. Now, it hasn't completely stopped. There's still mental health services there, but only on Wednesday. And when I have conversations with, say, the police chief, Phil Matrician, he does make the point that, you know, mental health emergencies occur every day. I mean, it's not like they wait till Wednesday. And, you know, there's a sense that this is part of a longstanding issue that raises hackles and brings complaints from people in Ellenville and Wawarsing and also Rochester, that our part of the county is the, you know, is ignored, is far away and not particularly part of the concern of those in Kingston, who we see when they want to run for election, but then we don't see them again. And that's, you know, that's the lament of remote places all over the world. But we don't feel that we're that remote. You know? So anyway, so that's the issue. There are mental health crises constantly. They sometimes lead to dreadful tragedies. We think that Ulster County needs to reconsider this and get mental health services in that building full time. And I'm waiting to hear from the county. I have sent questions to them, but I haven't heard back yet, but I'm expecting that I will. And that's a story that we will be following up. And of course, now I heard Philip's part of this, and I'm wondering if that's part of it as well, because it's on the other side of the issue, Ulster County being perhaps the smaller component, talking to Westchester, Westchester Health. So we'll have to see. That's developing. But there is no doubt that in Ellenville we have issues, and the pandemic has only accentuated some of these issues for people who perhaps have lost jobs or have had the virus and haven't done very well in recovery. You know, but there are a considerable number of problems. Now, one thing that Ulster County did do is create the mobile mental health operation, which roams around the county, bringing mental health largely on, I think, an emergency response, which is fine. But as the police in Ellenville will tell you, they can call and say, we've got somebody who's having a breakdown and he's a danger to everybody, or she is, and can we get something done? And it can take 90 minutes for the mobile mental health emergency service to show up. Well, that's a lot of time. The police, you know, can do so much, but only so much. And again, as the chief of police told me just this morning, there's two sides to this. On the one side, the Ellenville police, they're doing their training. They train police as much as they can to handle these sort of crises. But on the other side, they need the support of fully trained professionals, psychiatrists, psychologists, people who have this at a advanced level, PhDs, whatever. You know what I mean? Those two things, there's the two sides to this. And so far, it's mostly the police dealing with it. And, you know, they have the training. They can do a certain amount. Most of them are pretty sympathetic, but they can only go so far. They, you know, they need the rest of it. And then the other side of it is, as we said earlier on this, is mental health is an issue 7 days a week, not just Wednesday. So that's that story. And we'll just have to see how it develops and what we hear back from the county. And noting, of course, that we're going to have a change of county executive. Pat Ryan is moving on. He hopes to become a congressman. And we're looking to see who will appear out of the competition to replace him, and whether they'll be more interested and sympathetic to the southwest corner of Ulster County.
I remember when the casino was first built, there was an issue of work housing that developed, that there weren't enough housing around the area and around the casino area to support the workforce there. And obviously workforce housing has been an ongoing issue that was not brought in by the casino, but it came to the forefront that where are all these workers going to live? Early on, the Democrat did some reporting on some of the workers were coming from Ulster County, some of the workers were coming from Orange County, but I go back now for the past couple of years now, there is some projects in the works that will bring workforce housing, affordable housing, to places like Monticello that are near the casino. But, you know, like I said, this is not only happening here in Sullivan County or Ulster County, this is a nationwide problem, affordable workforce housing.
Yeah, it's a nationwide issue, you know, of course.
Yeah, it definitely is. But Chris, please keep us updated
on the housing situation in Ulster County and in Ellenville. Thank you to everyone for joining us for another edition for the Reporters Roundtable. I've been your host, Patrice Robayo. We've been joined by Leah Mayo from the River Reporter, Chris Raleigh with the Chihuahua Journal, Joseph Abraham from the Sullivan County Democrat, and Philip Pontuso from the Times Union. Don't forget that the Reporters Roundtable is a podcast. Search for WJFF, the Reporters Roundtable, wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
We'll be right back with more of Radio Chatskill and the archaeology of Woodstock.
This is Thane Peterson, host of WJFF's Living Jazz Show. Every Friday from noon to 2, I bring you the very best of the current jazz scene with a little bit of classic jazz thrown into the mix. This music will warm your heart and soothe your soul. Please join me for Living Jazz.
On January 6, 2021, then-Vice President Pence certified the results of the 2020 election. The committee investigating the attack on the Capitol says the pressure from Trump not to certify the results was enormous.
It is unambiguous that the vice president does not have the authority to reject electors.
Join us for live special coverage and analysis of the fourth public hearing Tuesday from NPR News.
Your NPR station for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Binghamton University students have been working on covering something unusual at the Bethel Woods Center for the Arts. It's the site of the Sandbox, one of six sculpture installations completed by the art crew at the 1969 Woodstock Festival. Dr. Neil V. Hitch is the senior curator at the museum at Bethel Woods, and he took Radio Catskill's Jason Dole on a tour of the dig right at the festival site.
So one of the things that is interesting about this cross trail that we are looking at is in searching for the trail, we also come across two sites, and this is a vendor kiosk. So unlike many of the other vendor kiosks, which are marked by kind of foundations where they kind of stacked up rocks, let's say. This one is just out in the open, and it's not necessarily one that we knew a location for, knew it was here.
Okay, I'm just breaking in here to explain that at this point of the tour, we are looking at a bit of a clearing in the woods, though it's barely discernible. It's not like we're surrounded by dense ancient Catskill Mountains trees here. Most of the trees are small, and there's plenty of dappled sunlight filtering all through as we walk. And from this particular spot, you can even see the old farmer's fields that now serve as extra parking at Bethel Woods on the western side of Hurd Road across from the venue. You can easily see these sunny green fields just beyond the nearby edge of the wood. So, more than a lack of trees, what literally marks this little clearing that we've arrived at are the dozens of little plastic flags scattered around. They're stuck on about foot-high wired stands, little wires sticking out of the ground with white flags, red flags, yellow flags, and a couple of people are clearing leaves from around the flags as Dr. Hitch continues.
Almost all of these flags are nails. So, again, the nail is worthless and it's almost all rusty, but what they're giving us as an indication where things were built and then torn apart, right, taken down. So this it's just a project of mapping another vendor site with students. This week we're doing archaeological field school with Binghamton University, so we have seven students on site kind of learning about the process of archaeology.
Wow. Another thing that people don't realize about Woodstock is there was a lot that wasn't completed, like the fences and the ticket booths and things, but there was a lot of work put into the grounds and the facilities that kind of get lost in the movie and lost in the history. People don't realize a lot of art stuff. They hired artists to do like different installments or do big signs. I know you got Mikey Randles to do a replication of one of those signs that was there at Woodstock, which I just think it's amazing because most people don't even know that existed. And here you've got somebody replicating it, you know?
So one of the things, Woodstock is one of the first festivals, if not the very first festival, that tries to create a holistic environment. It's not just a festival to see music. It's an environment to see music. And so it's why it's called the Music and Art Fair. And in the planning of it, art was a major component, and the creation of an artistic environment was a major component. We did. So there are students here from the University of Miami, two professors from the art department, and they have a contract to create art installations throughout the grounds. They create several in an area called the playground. Alton Kelly is here, one of the big five psychedelic poster artists. He's hired by a company. He comes and he does the signage. So you're making reference to the two big bendy signs. They are large orientation signs that were on site that showed, you know, they said you were here kind of thing. And those are the signs that say Bendy Bazaar and show the trail system that was here. They orient you to where the camping is, where the music is. And partly those signs say, go through the woods, get to the music. Again, all things that kind of didn't work because you didn't come in the main entrance where the sign was. So,
and everybody kind of just followed whatever crowd they were in.
That is correct. This year, our special exhibit is on the art that was at the Woodstock Festival, showcasing original pieces of art that were here, also showcasing the sign. So you made reference to a sign that Mikey Randles had reproduced. That's never been publicly displayed before, so you'll be able to see that for this year. It's in the exhibit hall that's in the basement of the museum. And in that exhibit, beginning about 2 weeks, we are also going to start reproducing what we call the horizontal bendy sign. And Mikey Randles will be working in that exhibit space, painting that sign. That sign will hang in the exhibit space all next year, and in 2024, we're working on a project to put that sign back where it was originally located, which when
part of your phase is 3 and 4 and stuff.
Yeah. So when you come to the woods, you can see where the main entrance was and you can see the orientation sign that was hanging there and you can walk the gentle path.
That's really cool. And so, am I correct in then thinking that with that emphasis that the original organizers put on art and environment and installation and creating this space, that's totally what these trails and that weird bridge and all that's about.
That is exactly right. If you think in terms of the Coachella Music Festival is an art and music festival, and they bring major artists in, they build installations. Everyone gets their selfie in front of the art installation. That getting your selfie at Coachella is as important as hearing a band at Coachella. That is what Woodstock was. Now, without the selfie, right?
Right.
But the other thing, I think a lot about this. Can you imagine anyone in 50 years doing archaeology on the Coachella site? I just can't imagine that is, like, even though Coachella is what it is, it's not Woodstock. It's not kind of this mythical, magical, cultural moment that, again, 53 years later, we are kind of still investigating, thinking about, having students learning, right? Doing like original kind of research. It's amazing. Now,
You're kind of answering a question that I always end up asking in these types of interviews. And I ask myself, as I think about this, as somebody who grew up in the area with all of this history and is like a fan of it. And you're kind of already answering his question, but I ask, what does this history mean? Not just now, but what's it going to mean moving forward when even those who weren't at the event are no longer with us?
So we think about this question here a lot. We get asked this question a lot. I think that, you know, we interact with a lot of visitors who have memories of the 60s, a lot who have memories of being at the event. We also are beginning to interact with a lot of visitors who don't. But Woodstock was a touchstone cultural moment that really has affected everything since then, both kind of commercial rock music as well as festival culture. And so, like, if you attend a festival today, it is a direct result of what happened on this site both in planning and the kind of the spontaneous amount of people that came, and that became a story so ingrained in our history that it kind of still runs through kind of other events that happen today.
This is Jason Dole talking to Dr. Neil Hitch, the senior curator at the museum at Bethel Woods. More information about Woodstock Uncovered at BethelWoodsCenter.org. We'll be right back with Mackenzie W. Kell and the Healing Power of Storytelling. This is WJFF Radio Chatskill.
Grayscale Darkroom and Photo Lab in the Narrowsburg Union is Sullivan County's only publicly accessible black and white darkroom, featuring a new 2-day intro to analog photography workshop with hands-on instruction in film processing and a guided photo walk through Narrowsburg with local photographers and teaching artists. Sessions are limited to 4 students per workshop for classes on July 23rd and 24th, August 27th and 28th, and September 24th and 25th. More information at grayscaledarkroom.com. Paid for by DVAA and Art Sullivan.
It's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, it's stories about people, their dads, and how food brought them closer together. From a teenager learning to bake bread with her dad as a way to calm her anxiety and eventually open a bakery, to a father and son who went from pretty much never really talking to making cooking videos together, it's Father's Day on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Tonight at 8, the Coshecton Pump House presents If Truth Be Told, a page-to-stage experience by Mackenzie W. Kell. It's the culmination of the 3 10-week memoir and monologue writing series Kell held throughout the area. I spoke to her about the art of storytelling and about turning her self-discovery and life experience into healing stories.
Something that struck me in your bio was that you're born a storyteller. How did you know you were born a storyteller? What does that mean?
That's a great question. I was always one of those people that had to talk to strangers. I remember in the grocery store, there was this man that would always sit. He was a homeless guy, and he would sit at the bench at the front of the grocery store, and I couldn't wait to go so I could sit and just talk to him. So as a child, I was just always interested in talking to people and telling stories, hearing stories. And all through school, I was always writing. Some of the students used to hire me to write poetry and stories that would be for like an enemy or something. And so I was always writing and always telling stories. But it wasn't until I would say right before I gave birth to my son, that I really started feeling the need to get my stories out to a wider audience. And so I joined something called TMI Project. It was really an amazing group. And we would tell stories that you wouldn't tell anybody. And then we would tell them on stage in front of hundreds of people. And I found it to be very addictive and healing. And so here we are now. And I've taken it to a different level. And I've been teaching the workshop now in 3 different places, and so tomorrow will be the culmination of our newest workshop.
And the workshop is Truth Be Told, a page-to-stage writing workshop. You started this in April in Roscoe for 10 weeks, and so this June performance is the culmination of that. What happened for you and your participants during this 10-week series?
Sure. So actually, this is the culmination of all 3 of my workshops. So I'm taking the one that I taught in Roscoe and the one that I taught down in Stone Ridge and one that I taught on Zoom. And I brought all my writers together to perform tomorrow. So what happened? Over the course of 10 weeks, I would give prompts to the students. Sometimes it would be ones that would bring out some of the heaviest stories from our lives. And some stories would be about our successes and some of the thrills from our life. And what we eventually did over the last few weeks is take all of those stories and find a common thread. And then we would have to take thousands and thousands of words and shorten it to a monologue. And so that's the work we've been doing over the last few weeks. What I can say is that my participants they range from in their 30s all the way up until their 70s. So these stories span, decades of living and storytelling and experience. And so we've kind of been riding along with everybody, and it's been emotional, it's been gorgeous, and it's been inspiring.
What were some of the things that people took away from it? You say that it's a healing journey. What were some of the healing journeys that some of your participants had?
I'm going to use one particular person. I'm not going to name their name, but I will say that almost every single time we had a workshop, this person said, I am never telling this on stage. And then the next week would come, I am never telling this on stage. And it would be some just really personal events, things that, you know, fear during COVID, shame about what people have done, things they did in their 20s that you just can't believe you would ever admit to anybody. And sure enough, I can tell you that almost all of these stories will make it to the stage tomorrow. So what happens is, when you have these stories that sit with you and you have a lot of shame around them or fear around them, it's when you start to voice them and own them and let them go that they no longer haunt you. And then they kind of just become like, oh, wow, that's a part of me. And it's almost like a bird's eye view of yourself. And then you realize the thing that you can do with these stories is to pass them on to somebody else, because somebody else needs to hear it. Someone needs to know that they weren't alone in perhaps a similar experience. And so that's where the healing comes in.
And these stories aren't just about tragic moments or healing in some ways. It's healing in other ways too, right? There are times of joy and other experiences that people are able to share as well, right?
Absolutely. So let me give you an example. I'm editing right now a story that one woman wrote about making dough with her grandmother. And it's one of the most beautiful things that you can imagine, just being there with her, making this dough with her grandmother and the flour. And I mean, it's really sometimes just the simple moments in life that are worth sharing as well. You know, we get beautiful childhood moments. We get the birth of children in these workshops. We get marriages. We get divorce. We get all of it. So, yes, there are many healing, beautiful moments as well.
You mentioned that you are bringing the workshops together. Those folks in these separate places haven't seen each other or reacted to those stories yet.
Well, we did do a Zoom call with each other so that everybody could at least meet each other. It's really important to create just a little bit of a connection with each other. So they've met through the screen. But no, some of them have never met each other in their lives.
And they haven't heard these stories. Yeah, they haven't heard these stories. So there'll be this other layer of being able to bring these stories to life, not only to the audience, but to all these fellow workshop members.
Absolutely. And I'm doing edits that some folks don't even know what they're about to get to read. So it's really, we're going right up to the last moment. And of course, mine will be the last one finished.
Yeah, people tend to put themselves in a bucket when it comes to this, like a writer or a poet, author. But, you know, you're talking more about storytelling, which encompasses all of these things. What do you want folks to know about storytelling and what the impact that that has?
Yeah, you know, it's so important. I mean, you'll find that the people who take the stage, they all have their own unique voice. I couldn't say that it's not poetry or it is poetry. Some folks even sound like they're singing when they're speaking. So for me, the word storytelling does encompass it all. You know, we sometimes can stand in the grocery line and have a conversation with somebody. That's storytelling. Giving anything that you've experienced in any manner. I mean, songs are storytelling, right? So for me, it's really just a matter of taking your experience and passing it on. That is the birth of story. Yeah.
Do you have plans for future writing series and workshops?
Absolutely. There'll be one starting in July, and I'll be taking sign-ups at all of our shows if anybody wants to join. The exact dates and times and locations have not been landed on, but mid-July we will be beginning again.
If truth be told, the memoir and monologue writing series performance is tomorrow at the Coshecton Pump House at 8 o'clock. More information at CoshectonPumpHouse.com or MackenzieWKell.com. And that's who we've been talking to. Mackenzie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tim. Have a great one.
And a correction, that event is actually today. We recorded that interview yesterday. So the event, If Truth Be Told, Storytelling, Page to Stage Experience at the Coshecton Pump House today at 8. Tomorrow is Juneteenth, commemorating the emancipation of enslaved African Americans on the anniversary announcement of General Order No. 3 by Union Army General Gordon Granger on June 19, 1865, proclaiming freedom for enslaved people in Texas. Today in Monticello, the NAACP of Sullivan County, the Village of Monticello, and the E.B. Crawford Public Library are having a Juneteenth celebration kicking off at noon. WJFF's Patricio Rubio spoke to Sandra Johnson Fields of the Sullivan County NAACP.
A lot of people don't know about Juneteenth. And so last year we had one that, you know, was a little bit broadcasted more. And then this year, of course, since it's a federal holiday, but it's always been some type of celebration in Sullivan County. It just hasn't been large.
So what does Juneteenth mean to you, Sandra? What does it mean to you personally?
Juneteenth means to me it's the Black Independence Day. You know, this is the day that the last enslaved blacks who were brought to this country by force were set free. And so it marks our independence totally.
NAACP and the Village of Monticello and the Library Monticello are participating in this celebration for Juneteenth that's happening in Monticello starting at noon. What can you tell us about what's going to happen?
Sure. It's going to be a parade. This is the first parade that we're having to mark Juneteenth since it's been a federal holiday. Because this is the first year, so most people are off on Monday because it is a federal holiday. And so we're having a celebration June 18th on Saturday, even though Juneteenth is officially on June 19th, but that's Father's Day. And so we didn't want to interfere with those who want to celebrate their fathers. And so what's going to happen is we're going to march in the parade from the police department in Monticello to the library. All of Sullivan County is going to be represented in the parade. We have the bigger cities have opted to be in it. We have Liberty representation from their police department, their school system, their politicians. We have Fallsburg involved with their police department, their school system, as well as Monticello. You know, the same thing, their police department, their school system, everyone's involved. Because the NAACP is for Sullivan County, not just Monticello. And so we're excited that we have people coming from New York City, the drummers, we have drummers coming. We have local drummers as well. We have people who are going to sing. We have stilt walkers who are going to be there. We have activities for children planned. We also are going to have a refreshment period. So we're very excited about what's to come and that we get a chance to really celebrate it in a larger scale and to really have more involvement than just the NAACP.
Juneteenth became a federal holiday in 2001. And now you talked about the other celebrations that didn't get a lot of fanfare, but now it is. Now there's a federal holiday. Now you're going to have a parade down Monticello Broadway. How does it feel? How does it feel that now the holidays are getting the recognition that it deserves?
It's great. It's long overdue that it's being recognized as a federal holiday. You know, it's always been celebrated in the large scale in Texas, all throughout Texas, and Lubbock, Texas especially, has a huge celebration in Galveston. And Buffalo, New York has the entire town is involved. And it'll probably have special meaning for them this year since they just went through that horrible event with the mass shooting that just went on. And so we're excited because now more people will learn about it. We already knew about it. Many African Americans and people of color knew about Juneteenth already. It's just now becoming widely known, and the information is widely circulated to other communities. And also our children. Now our children will get a chance to really, really understand that this is our day of liberation and that what it stands for.
And after the parade, according to the flyer, there's going to be refreshments and I believe a vendor aisle there, which I'm assuming will be a lot of the organizations in Sullivan County represented. Is that correct?
Yes, we have so many representations from throughout Sullivan County. The college is also marching and they'll have a table. We have Sullivan 180 will be there. They have a table. You know, we have representation from vendors throughout. Sun River Health will be there. And, it'll be a lot of information given. It's also the first day for early voting. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that, and we'll have voters registration forms there and information about candidates that are going to be up for election. And so it's very special, because this year, again, I've been here just about 20 years, and I have yet to see a parade in Monticello. So to see a parade in Monticello with all of Sullivan County involved celebrating Black liberation is phenomenal for me. So I'm very excited about it.
Sandra, before we leave, is there anything I have not touched on that you want our listeners to know about?
No, just come on down and join us. You know, join us in the celebration and join us in learning more about Juneteenth and just being a part of the good feeling and good vibes that'll be going on that day.
It's Sandra Johnson Fields talking to Patricia Rubio. She's the Sullivan County NAACP president. And that parade is today at noon at the Monticello Police Department. It's where it's kicking off on Pleasant Street and ends at the library parking lot on Prince Street. Also today, lots going on in the Radio Catskill listening area. There's a Pride celebration in Calicoon. It starts at 1, and there's more information at catskillspride.com. Now, it's taking place on the 20th anniversary of Day to Be Gay, which also took place in Calicoon. Here's the lead from an article in the Sullivan County Democrat by Ted Waddell from August 20, 2001. The sleepy little hamlet of Calicoon is changing, and it may never be the same. Known for its annual tractor parade and farmers market, local folks took a leap of faith in their community and turned out in droves to support Day to Be Gay in the Catskills. The celebration of life's diversity was held Saturday afternoon at the Delaware Community Center and served notice that acceptance of one's neighbors was an integral part of life in the Upper Delaware Valley, according to attendees. That same spirit carried on for several years, and at one Day to Be Gay event, local musician David Driver performed with Gretchen Phillips and J.D. Sampson as their project Phillips and Driver, and they wrote a song for the occasion, Love Theme for a Day to Be Gay in the Catskills. David shared it with us, and I thought I'd share it with you as we wrap up today's edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening, and happy Pride.
Those other days are okay days, but they aren't like today.
Those other mountains will suffice in their undistinguished way. But we are here together in a special time and place to celebrate the Catskillosity of being gay.
Catskills.
A day for you to be yourself.
Day to be gay in the Catskills.
Or maybe even someone else.
Day to be gay in the Catskills.
The world supports your happiness. Day to be gay.
Woo!
Day to be gay.
Woo!
Day to be gay.
Woo!
Day to be gay. We all have our preferences for how to live our lives. Those special folks who make our days, with whom we fraternize.
And while we are all standing here, let's celebrate the chance to get up off our sweet gay ass and do a little dance.
In the Catskills.
A day for you to be yourself.
Day to be gay in the Catskills. Or maybe even someone else.
Day to be gay in the Catskills.
The world supports your happiness.
Day to be gay.
Woo!
Day to be gay.
Woo!
Day to be gay.
Woo!
Day to be gay.
All right.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, your NPR station for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Canoza Hall, featuring 22 guest rooms, a fine dining restaurant with full bar by Foster Supply Hospitality's award-winning culinary team, outdoor Lakeview seating, and a full-service spa. CanozaHall.com. from the River Reporter newspaper in Narrowsburg, New York, riverreporter.com, and from listener donations at wjffradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello.
Radio Catskill.
On air, online, on your smartphone, and on your smart speaker.
Public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. We are Radio Catskill, keeping you connected.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.